The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone, and Happy New Year. So, it's the custom here at IMC that the first talk of the years, the first Monday talk of the year, is always on the Four Noble Truths. And the reason for that is that Four Noble Truths lays at the beginning of Buddhist practice and Buddhist teaching. It's the very foundation of it. And it's sometimes said that all Buddhist teachings are an explanation or a development or application of this core teaching of the Four Noble Truths. So in looking at the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, we see that one way of understanding it is that it's a exploration of the issue of choice, where we have choice in our life and how we exercise choice, and to understand both the choices we can make and the places and how to make choices. And so there are lots of things we don't have any much choice about. We don't have, we have very, very little choice about the weather. Some places they seed the clouds for rain, but the weather comes and goes. And there's a variety of environmental things that happen to us that that can affect us, which we have no choice about. But we have choice about how, what we do about it raining, so if, or about the weather, so how we respond to it. So if it rains, we might get a raincoat. So that's a choice that we have. Or more closely inside, we have some choice about how we think about the weather, or our attitude about the weather, or, you know, internally our reaction to the weather. So if we have strong dislike for the rain, and we kind of are get angry at the weather, then we have some choice about that anger. So this inner world of where the choice is what Buddhism focuses on. There's also the world of sickness, old age, and death. We don't have much choice around, certainly about getting old. Certainly those of us who are lucky enough to get old have no choice about getting old. And then we have no choice about dying. Or we have no choice about, in a sense, we don't have no choice about, you know, people we know die around us. Today I wrote a letter to someone who is dying. And it was kind of my farewell letter to him. I'd never done that before. So it was very touching for me to write write words to someone of appreciation and gratitude. It was kind of like doing a eulogy while the person was still alive or something like that. So the sickness, old age, and death are kind of this code words in Buddhism for what visits all of us and what all of us are contending with and dealing with. And so to some degree, to a big degree, we don't have much choice about this happening to us, but we do have choice about how we relate to it. So do we get angry? Do we get afraid? Do we cling to it? Do we try to push it away? Do we deny it? These are all these internal movements. And this is the world that Buddhism focuses on, Buddhist practice. It focuses on the place inside our minds or our hearts where we have some ability to choose one way or the other. And if we look a little bit internally to what happens with our mind and hearts, we can see that there's a big difference between having freedom around the place of choice and not having freedom. So sometimes we'll notice that we act on compulsion. We say something, and afterwards we wonder, why did I say that? That just came out of my mouth. Or we do something. And there's a variety, all kinds of things that people do. And sometimes it's not a surprise. Sometimes people are doing them while, know they're doing it while they're doing it. And while they're doing it, they know they shouldn't be doing it. But there's something else that's taken over. Strong addiction, strong desire, a strong compulsion is going on. So there's no freedom in that kind of compulsion. And when there's no freedom, there's no choice. That's kind of the nature of compulsion. There's the other kind of limitation to our freedom is inhibition. So we get inhibited. There's movements, desires, wishes that we have, and we don't want to act on them. We don't want to kind of express it. We're held back. We're limited. And so this world of inhibition and compulsion is the world in Buddhism that is the world of suffering, this internal suffering. The place. So when we can't exercise our freedom, then it's more likely that's a place we're going to suffer. There's something about compulsive activity which either is painful in and of itself or leads to pain and suffering down the line. And there's something certainly about being inhibited or checked or limited, which also is certainly unpleasant, certainly involves a loss of freedom. So Buddhism puts a big emphasis on freedom, becoming free. And so to become free of the forces of compulsion, the forces of restriction that go around our hearts or go in our own mind. So the Four Noble Truths are an exploration of this area of where we have choice. So I'll start today with the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, which is the truth of a path of practice. So Buddhism puts a tremendous importance on practicing. It's a kind of, you find Buddhists use the word practice all the time. And so the idea of walking a path, of making choices around how we behave and what we do and what we think. So again, exercising the act of choice. So the first thing is the first step in this Eightfold Path is right view, having the right understanding. And it's not so much a matter of just having some knowledge, but it has to do with choosing what frame of reference we're going to use to explore our life, to help our life along. It's kind of like what medicine is useful, or what you know, what questions are useful to bring along as you go about your life. So if you live in the desert, perhaps in the Sahara Desert, perhaps it's a wrong question to ask which kind of umbrella you should get. Well, I guess they have sun umbrellas. But you know, but there's the kind of right and wrong questions or helpful questions in this particular context. So in Buddhism, the helpful question to have, if you want to be free of compulsion, is to understand where is that compulsion? Where does compulsion act for you? Where are you driven? And so there's no freedom or no choice. And so the first of the Eightfold Path, the right view, has to do with understanding the nature of compulsive activity, driven activity, and looking at it carefully and understanding what drives it, what makes it work. And then looking and seeing, is it possible, how can we exercise choice in letting go of it? So the first choice then, in other words in Buddhism, is a choice to choose a particular series of questions with which to explore our life. We'll come back to that when we get to the end and maybe understand how important this is. So it's not just a matter of, again, of knowledge or of a belief system, but it is a matter of choosing particular tools that are going to be useful for you. So you're going to use this tool, this frame of reference, for beginning to understand your experience. So the next one is right intention, the second of the Eightfold Path. And this has to do with choosing a general, broad kind of attitude with which you're going to kind of then explore this territory. So if what you want to do is to become free of compulsive activity, become free of restricted movements in your own mind, inhibitions, such things, it's helpful if you explore that and start asking these questions with an attitude of kindness or friendliness and an attitude of compassion and an attitude of letting go, of not holding on to things. Because holding on to things is a form of compulsion. I like to think of it as holding things lightly, being light about it. So the first of the Eightfold Path involves choosing and understanding, exercising your choice, what understanding you're going to use for your life. It can seem very oppressive to some people to say, oh, now I'm supposed to have a particular understanding, I'm supposed to adopt this understanding, and then even worse, adopt an attitude. But in fact, you're operating under an understanding all the time, and you're operating under an attitude all the time. And is the understanding and attitude you're currently operating on, is it helpful for you? Is that really the best one you could, you know, is it really something you've chosen? Or has it been chosen for you by society and family and who knows what, by your personality or something? So we start looking at understanding and attitudes very broadly, very kind of just in very, not in a heavy way, not in some difficult way, but just kind of just very generally. Then the next three steps of the Eightfold Path is we begin exercising choice around how we speak, how we act in the world, and what kind of livelihood we engage in. We can raise these issues only because we have some choice in these matters. So when we speak, do we speak the truth or do we lie? Do we have some choice about that? If you always are telling the truth, then it's not an issue. But if you find yourself saying things which are not true, then are you doing that compulsively? We talk about compulsive liars. Or are you doing it not so compulsively but for other reasons? And does it really serve you? Can you exercise your choice there and find a way of speaking where you choose to speak the truth? Do you speak harshly? Do you speak in mean ways? Do you gossip? Is your speech divisive? Does it cause division among other between people? If it does, then you could exercise choice about how you speak. You could choose not to say those things and maybe choose to speak other ways. In your behavior, actions, you can choose to avoid action which harm, hopefully. You start exercising that the best you can. Start exercising the option not to steal if you're taking what's not given. You can exercise the option of not engaging in sexual misconduct. You can engage in the option and the choice of not lying. And then you can engage the option, the choice around alcohol and drugs. Not intoxicate yourself. So all along here, we're exercising this muscle of choosing one thing over the other. This is really important, one thing over the other. As we do that, we're exercising freedom. We're exercising our ability not to be caught by one particular way that's habit, that's reactivity, that's addiction, and choosing, and by choosing, putting ourselves in the camp of free, in a sense, free will, of choice, of loosening ourselves from the driven mode in which the mind can be. Then we get to the sixth step of the Eightfold Path, which is right effort. And here, right effort is all about exercising choice. In the simplest way, it's about choosing those activities and actions which are healthy for you and avoiding those which are unhealthy for you. Very simple. So you can't really argue with that. You know, if something is unhealthy for you, then, and you do it even against your best judgment, even, you know, I know I shouldn't be doing this, you're not free. So we're beginning to find, and also, so as we begin looking and understanding what is healthy, what brings me suffering, what brings me happiness, and can I kind of choose between these two? It can be something as simple, as I said, as I talked about yesterday, Sunday morning here, something simple as how do you drive your car? Are the healthy ways of driving your car or unhealthy ways? I've noticed in my own driving there are times where I know, in principle, I have a choice about how I drive. But sometimes I get contracted, a little bit tight, a little bit pushing, pressure, about getting somewhere a little bit faster than a healthy, relaxed mode of being would be. And then I could see these internal arguments inside of me about, oh, if I can just do all these things quickly, then I can get to the important things in life. And so I'm caught by my desires, by my wishes, by what I think is important. And that translates to a particular mode of being which is not so pleasant to be in. If I'm really honest and look inside and feel what it's like to be a person internally in these modes of being driven and caught and in a hurry, it doesn't feel good inside. So do I have choice, and what choices do I make about how I drive? It might seem like a very petty issue, but it's an example of the kind of issues that come up in our life over and over again in many different situations. The important thing here I'm emphasizing is beginning to exercise the possibility of choice and seeing where we have choice and where we don't. Then the second to last fold of the Eightfold Path is right mindfulness. So the practice of mindfulness, of attention. And this is the practice of looking much more deeply. What's really going on here? Not just what meets kind of our surface of our life as we just kind of go about our life busy or whatever, but stopping and looking in some deeper way. What's really happening here with us? And that's when we start becoming aware of a variety of things. One is we can become aware of the cost, internal cost, of how we're living our life. We can become aware of the degree to which we might be much more unhappy than we originally thought. There might be much more suffering and tension and stress than we were aware of, than if we were always kind of driven and blinded by what we want and what we don't want, and we're not paying attention to the inner world. Much more important, as the mindfulness gets stronger, we start seeing more and more subtle places of choice, where we can choose one thing over the other. So, for example, in meditation, you sit down to meditate and try to be with the breathing, and most people, most human beings, will find that their mind is out of control, that there is a very intense movements of, some people would say, addiction to thinking. And so sometimes some meditators find it very hard to exercise the option of choice around what they think about. They try to be with the breath, and the mind can wander off very quickly. So what do we do? Do we let the mind wander off freely, compulsively? We give the mind its freedom to think whatever it wants to think. Or can we find where we have choice about where the mind goes or where the mind doesn't go? And so do we have choice there? And hopefully we discover, as we meditate, more and more choice about, oh no, I'm not going to go there. I don't have to think about that. I can put that down. I cannot get involved in that. I can let go of it. And so we're strengthening this capacity to choose at this more and more subtle levels when we meditate. It's very hard when we go about our life, busy life, to track our mind that carefully and to see moment by moment where the mind is going, left and right, this idea and that idea. But in meditation, you start seeing that and finding more freedom in that regard. Then the last fold of the Eightfold Path is concentration. And this is beginning to develop a real stability in the mind, so that the mind, it's very stable, can begin seeing below the surface chatter, the surface concerns, the surface activity of the mind, and see what in Buddhism is said to be the very roots of our behavior. Sometimes it's called latent. The roots of our behavior, the kind of the core motivating factors that drive us. So are we... So it's very hard to see those common denominator for behavior. And the function of concentration is to be able to see these things very clearly. So in the Eightfold Path, all along the way, we're exercising choice. We're developing, strengthening our capacity to choose. Then we come back again to the first of the Eightfold Path. It's sometimes seen as a spiral, these eight steps. Come back to the first one. And the first one, in the most classic description of it, formulation of it, is called the using the framework of the Four Noble Truths to understand our experience. So again, this is not a belief system, you have to believe it or not, but rather it's a pragmatic truth. So, for example, if you have a wound, it's a pragmatic truth that if you keep the wound clean, that you will be, it'll heal better. It's not a philosophical or religious truth, it's just a pragmatic one. So the Four Noble Truths are meant to be pragmatic truths in that kind of way. So the Four Noble Truths begin with the truth of suffering. And the truth of suffering is that if you look at your life carefully, or maybe sometimes not so carefully, you'll see that your life and the lives of others has a fair degree of suffering in it, of unhappiness. And the corollary of that is that if there is suffering, then maybe there's a possibility of being free of suffering, of happiness. So the Buddhist approach to happiness is to begin by studying and becoming sensitive to where we suffer. Then the second noble truth has to do with the condition or cause from which this suffering arises. And the Buddhist analysis of suffering is that suffering arises from clinging, from craving, from compulsion. When we're driven by desires. Desires are not the cause of suffering. So that's a very important to underscore. I looked at a book today, Introduction to Buddhism book. And I looked, like a big, hefty book, serious book. And so I wanted to see what this book said about the Four Noble Truths, since I was going to talk about it today. And there, in solid bullet points, it said the first noble truth is that life is suffering. The second bullet point for the second noble truth was this: desire is the cause of suffering. This is a common misunderstanding, and it's very depressing to read that life is suffering. And if desire is the cause of suffering, well, then it's hopeless. Because that's what human beings are, human desirelings. That's what human minds do. They have desires. sometimes we want to go to the pee. I have a desire to go pee. Enlightened people have that desire. Or they have diapers. So desires are not the problem, and life is not suffering. That's not what the Buddha taught. What the Buddha said is, there is suffering. There's a huge difference between those two. And the suffering that Buddhism wants to address is a suffering that doesn't come from desire, but comes from being driven by desire, being addicted to desire, caught by desire, pushed around by desire. So I prefer the language of craving and clinging as the cause or the condition for the arising of suffering. And you see that because when there is craving or clinging, there's compulsion. And generally around compulsion, there's also contraction, tightness, restriction, narrowing down, darkening of the mind and heart, and a variety of things that feel very unpleasant, which, in shorthand Buddhism calls suffering. So then the task in Buddhism is not only to understand suffering, but to begin understanding where that compulsion is, and discover how can we become free of this compulsion. And because the third noble truth is a truth of the cessation of clinging and the cessation of suffering. This is the good news. So there's suffering, the cause of suffering, the possibility of ending suffering, and a path to ending suffering. Those are the Four Noble Truths. To say it in a different way, there is happiness. No, say it differently. There's suffering and the cause of suffering, and then there's happiness and the conditions for happiness. So this is kind of the domain of exploration in Buddhism. So there are simple things, like how we drive our car, maybe, that maybe it's kind of very easy to exercise the choice to see, oh, I'm driven, I'm kind of impatient here, and I'm kind of tightening up a little bit in my body, my mind, my eyes, so trying to get someplace fast and judging all the drivers around me and honking, you know, telling them to get out of the way and kind of caught up in the whole world of driving. Maybe I can see that and I can just let go and sit back in the seat and relax. But then there are much deeper things that we get caught by. There are deep, for example, there's all kinds of things, but for example, the world of human relationships. You know, people are very driven by all kinds of desires and wishes, expectations, fears around being in relationship with people. Tremendous amount of suffering arises in this world of relationship. Do we see the place of choice where it operates in our relationships? After I've been meditating for, I don't know how long, 4 or 5 years, I was in my mid-20s, and I got very interested to see if I could notice the moment of choice where I chose to fall in love with the woman. And lo and behold, I could see it. If I was really still and quiet and paid a very careful attention, it wasn't just like lightning or just, it didn't just like happen. you know, it was just chemistry and, you know, I'm not in control, you know, just, but it was very subtle. You know, oh, reaching for something that was very pleasant or desirable or enjoyable or satisfying or something. I could see that choice being operating. How about if you get angry with someone? Can you see the place of choice in buying onto the anger? Or when you get afraid, can you see the place of choice? As you exercise the place of, as you see the place of choice, then you have choice, then you have freedom. People who don't see the place of choice have no choice. And then being kind of operating an automatic pilot or being operated, kind of being driven by all kinds of internal forces or external forces. So in order to become free in Buddhism, we have to have the capacity to begin seeing where we have choice and to find more and more and more, where is the place of choice? There are some Buddhist practitioners who think that enlightenment and awakening is not a choice. It's not something they're going to choose. If they just sit quietly and wait, do their duty as a good Buddhist meditator, they'll have the big bang of enlightenment. Something will happen to them. And they're waiting for that wonderful moment of grace or explosion. There may be some element of grace involved. I'm not going to say it's not. But to sit and wait and not take responsibility is to abdicate this whole exploration of choice and exercising choice, which is so important in Buddhism. One of the reasons why this is very important is it's a very powerful way of protecting, of being protected. So for example, in our social world, our relational world, you know, of course, if someone's hitting you, then you need to do something about that. But if someone's speaking to you and say unkind things to you, where are you protected? Where are you best protected in that situation? What protects you from that? You could get earplugs so you don't hear it, but that's usually not very effective. You could get a mouth stopper for them, but that's, you know, they don't sell mouth stoppers like that, so it's usually not, it's frowned upon. But the Buddhist approach of looking at where you can be protected, best protected, the place where you can be most securely protected, is to stop and look at how is it that you react to those unkind things that are being said. If I say that, people with hair are kind of, you know, silly, then most of you, how would you react to that? I hope most of you would just like, you know, it wouldn't do anything to you. But people can say something, I could say something like, you know, people with hair are silly. And someone might say, oh no, the teacher thinks that I am silly now because I have hair. I better go get a haircut. I better get a hat and hide my hair. I better get angry at this teacher who doesn't know what he's talking about. Has no business judging people's hair. After all, he's a Buddhist teacher. He shouldn't be doing such things. I'm going to give him a piece of my mind. There's all these internal movements that can happen in there. When we can exercise the place of choice and see it, we can say, oh, this person said this odd thing. Maybe he's even, you know, I don't agree with it. Maybe the person shouldn't have said it. I'm just going to not do anything. I'm just going to let it be. In just letting it be, there is protection from your internal world of reactivity. That's a very powerful place of protection. To exercise the ability to leave things alone. Not going to go there. Not going to pick that up. I'm not going to react. I just let it be. There's a lot of protection there, because the primary way that we get hurt, the primary way we suffer, is not from what people say to us or do to us, but rather is what we do as a result of that. How we pick it up, how we close down, how we push back, what we do inside. So as we explore this area of choice, one of the great things we learn is to choose the choice of doing nothing. It's not the only thing we should do, but doing nothing is very powerful. This works very well when we look internally to our own mind, because our own mind is not necessarily under our control. What we think, the feelings that come up, the ideas that happen. But we have an amazing capacity, if we develop it, of not getting involved with the thoughts and feelings and desires that bubble up in our mind. Oh, look at that. Now I'm judging someone because of their hair. That judging thought arose, I'm not going to go there. I'll leave it alone. I don't know why it went there, why the mind's doing that, but I'm just going to leave it and not do anything with it. Or I have a desire. A desire bubbles up. Or an aversion bubbles up in the mind. Or a memory bubbles up. Or something, you know, all kinds of things bubble up. So, oh, I just leave it there. Tanisara Bhikkhu, this monk who teaches here sometimes, he likes to compare or liken the human mind to a corporate board room, corporate board, where you're the chairman of the chair of the board, and you have this unruly board of directors. And you have no control over what the board of directors say. But as a chair of the board, you have veto power. So you can say, no, we're not going to go there. So the same thing with the mind. The mind can do all kinds of different things, but we have the ability to say, no, I'm not going to go there. So that's exercising our capacity for choice in a very effective way. As this capacity to say no becomes stronger, then also we can exercise the capacity to choose what we do want to do. To do those things which are supportive and helpful for happiness, for greater freedom, for greater love and joy in our life. And this is then the Eightfold Path. And so it goes in around in a spiral. So the Eightfold Path, we begin appreciating or exploring our life from the point of view of these Four Noble Truths. We cultivate an attitude that is optimal for exploring this part of our life, attitude of kindness, compassion, and letting go. We begin living a life that is supportive of this effort, looking at how we speak, looking at how we act, and looking at how we make our living. And then we begin looking much more carefully within to see what are the movements inside, in the mind, in the heart, in our feelings, in our motivations, our choices, internal choices, to see where we have choice between choosing that which is helpful and that which is not. And begin exercising that internal movement. So the internal life is the only place where you can have the optimal choice or control or a development of responding and living wisely in this life around us. And then the seventh and eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is generally understood to be meditation, practicing meditation, because in this wonderful laboratory of sitting quietly, sitting still, it seems to be a really great place where we're not distracted by all the things of life, really great place to look deeply inside, to find more and more, kind of follow back the stream right down to the source of what motivates us in our life. And then somehow find that place where it all begins and find how to somehow radically change or radically make a radical choice to choose freedom at the foundation of our life rather than compulsion. And do it so radically at the foundation of it all, because it's like the root of it all, that once that choice is made at the root, all kinds of other things will follow in its wake. All kinds of beautiful things will follow. It's like a ripple effect. And then it's possible to live a much happier life, and hopefully a life that not only is better for ourselves, but also better for others. I'm very fond of the fact that the Four Noble Truths, as taught by the Buddha, do not have a pronoun connected to them. There's no, it doesn't say, these are the Four Noble Truths for you, you know, or I. You suffer, or I suffer. It just says there is suffering. There is a cause of suffering. There is the freedom from suffering, and there's a path for it. And because there's no pronoun, I like to see it as being an approach to life that's very inclusive, where we actually include others very deeply in our life. And so the very path to freedom that the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths point to, leads us to a life that then hopefully is very supportive and helpful for other people to also find this path of freedom. So, I hope that you find it enjoyably challenging to begin studying where you have choice and begin expanding the range and the subtlety in your life where you begin exercising or acting with choice. Because if you don't do that, then you're not free. And is that what you choose? I hope you don't. So, thank you.